concept to bind together around. When that's an influential idea down to today.
In terms of logistics, when do you want me to let you know about the Q&A?
Well, I don't. I think I'll be okay. But if it gets to the point where there's only 15 minutes left and I haven't stopped, you know, going on, then maybe you should give me a sign. But I think we'll be all right. Okay. Okay. What we were talking about was this idea of what it means to say. Oh, we got another question. What it means to say that things that can exist conventionally, or what it means to say that things don't have any existence, that any way of existing apart from being posited through the force of consciousness. This is what Tsongkhapa says, that when we say self or intrinsic nature, it's what we're referring to is a mode of existing without being posited through the force of consciousness. So just to be clear, Tsongkhapa does think that there are external objects. He's not an idealist. He doesn't think that all things are of one nature with the mind. As a prasangik, he believes there are external objects, which means that there are objects that conventionally are of a different entity from the mind that's apprehending them. What he's saying is something different from that. He's saying these external objects have no way of setting themselves up objectively in and of themselves. They exist in relationship to a particular perspective. And we think of them as just naturally being a certain kind of thing, and we passively, unless we have something wrong, we just like passively receive that information. But in fact, they're being X or Y, and just like, okay, there's some external objects in the world, but you can't just say, okay, well, let's make a list of them. No, it depends on, well, list of them from whose point of view, from what point of view, taking in consideration what perspective. The things are only constituted in relationship to a perspective, even though there are external things, but you can't say what they are, except in terms of like how they are, what they are from a certain point of view. That's exactly the thing. So that's like the rainbow is an example. A is an example. I mean, you think of it as like, it's not that things don't exist at all. It's not that they don't exist as separate entities from consciousness. It's just that you can't say it's this or that and say, oh, well, apart from how it is that from a particular point of view. Okay. So then how do you like say, well, it's right for it to be, say that there's one moon in the sky and not two moons in the sky, because I could have a point of view that says there are two moons in the sky. Well, one thing is like the way Chandrakirti says is like, well, that person has impaired sense faculties. You know, it's like the people who have unimpaired vision are able to damage or critique the perspective of other people, you know, who and say, look, you know, you have a fault in your vision, which is causing you to see like this, right? And then how would we verify, you know, who had the right one? Well, we can go and check, you know, and like if actually out there and see how many moons that we come across when we fly out there. So it's like the same thing as you have some people, there's somebody who says feels very strongly that from my point of view, in terms of my perspective, there's some water out there in the desert. That doesn't mean that there's water out there in the desert, right? It could be that your sense faculties are, it's not that you've taken any drugs, it's not, you know, that it's not that you have anything impairment in your vision, it's just that the way the heat is rising off the sand is an external cause that is impairing your vision so that you're seeing vividly the appearance of water where there's like no, where there is, it's not suitable to see water, right? There isn't any basis which is appropriately to be imputed water in that place. So that's why this isn't Tsongkhapa making up. That's why Chandrakirti explains that there's difference at the conventional level. Even though there's nothing there on the side of the object, there's a difference in the conventional level. He says, well, it's in terms of whether these people have unimpaired sensory faculties or they have impaired sensory faculties. That's the That's the exactly the way Chandrakirti makes the distinction. So a kind of question that comes up, and maybe this is related to one of the questions that's in the pile, is like, okay, so when we say that that's an A, and then I say, yeah, but you know, you're designating it an A. It seems to be an A from its own side, but when you know you think about it, you realize that we're all kind of designating it as an A, imputing, ascribing, or assigning it that identity. And so it's coming from our side. And it's like, well, there has to be something coming from the object side too, because otherwise, what would make it there must be like a shape that's there on the object side that makes it appropriate for us to make that designation, right? Well, that's true, except that you have to remember that there's a basis of designation and an object imputed. Tsongkhapa is not saying there are no such things as bases of designation, right? When you make a designation or an imputation or an ascription of a certain identity, if you know I say Diana in relationship to this collection of aggregates, then it's like, well, the basis of imputation is not matching with the object of imputed. So then you say, oh, so you agree that there are some like bases of imputation. Yes, but the bases of imputation, again, are also as perceived from a certain point of view. That's the problem. You can't say that objectively, in and of itself, from its own side and independent of any point of view, these are just naturally the appropriate set of aggregates to be designated as Joshua. But from within our point of view as human beings, correctly having conventional understanding about Joshua's mind and body or shape and color is actually probably for us because we're not perceiving his mind right now. Maybe later on we'll get to that point. And then, so then we go, Joshua in relationship to that. So it's like, you know, we want to think, well, you know, it's true. We imputed that, you know, Joshua, and that was like an ascription. But what we know is that there's some real thing that's there on the object side, which is those bases of designation, right? But he doesn't have any like inherently existent shape or color too. Those are all subject to the same kinds of deconstruction, and they're all, you know, something that exists as those shapes and color only relative to a certain point of view that for which a human point of view, you know, with unimpaired sense faculties, for which it's appropriate to make that designation. To get us feeling, you know, okay, so one thing to say, when you say that things exist merely as the designations or the only from the point of view of certain kinds of consciousness, then some people say, if things are mere imputations by mind or by thought, then people say, yeah, but what's the thought that, you know, imputes the tree falling in the forest when no one's watching and so forth? And like, there are a lot of answers to these kinds of, or you know, who is watching the Big Bang and so forth. So there's a lot of answers to these kinds of questions that have been posited differently by different Gelugpa scholars. And in Appearance and Reality, I try to catalog some of the different answers I've seen. And, you know, Alan Wallace has written some of his ideas about this in some of his books. Then in Anne Klein's Path to the Middle, she writes some stuff about it as well. But, you know, as I was saying before, I think if you look very carefully in the Dalai Lama's How to See Yourself as You Really Are, I think he gives what to me is the best answer, to say it's not a matter of going out and finding for each thing, what is the mind that's there, like ascribing or imputing or identifying it at that time. When you say that things don't have any way of existing except through the force of consciousness, what you're really saying is that there's nothing, when we search for the shape and color that are the appropriate basis of designation in which to impute, which we've agreed that there's a merely imputedly existent Josh there, but now we're thinking he must have some real basis of designation which make it so that it's okay for us to do this. But when we search to say, well, you know, what is the real shape and color of Josh, you know, then we come up against the same problem, and that there's nothing in or among the basis of designation that is the object imputed. And this is actually the unique perspective of Prasangika. There's a mere Josh that's imputed in relationship to Josh's, for us, we're just saying we're going to impute a relationship to shape and color at this time, you know. And that mere Josh that's being imputed in relation to that shape and color, those bases of imputation are also, you know, these merely existent shapes or colors, which we you know, can descriptively identify it when we stop to think about it in relationship to how those things exist for us as human beings. It's not that they objectively have any status like that from their own side independently. So now I know that's a little hard to understand. It took me a long time to decide that that's what I really think about what imputation by thought means. Imputation by thought just means that it's not like we have to find the thought that's doing each imputation each second. You don't find it. And that's what Kensari Yeshe Tupten, in my opinion, is trying to teach in The Path to the Middle when he gives that butter example. You don't have to go around and find the thought that at each moment is doing each imputation. It's a Geshe Benda Thakura told me that when you say things are mere imputations by thought, what you're doing is giving people a clue about the ontological status of things, is that it's that they have no status of existing from their own side, and that when you turn the mind to it, there is this kind of these things are suitable to be ascribed or identified as certain things from the point of view of certain kinds of living beings. Now, in order to feel what this means or to get a sense of what I'm talking about, you know, you have to use the example of the juxtaposition of different points of view about the same object. And then you can see, well, this isn't the same as realism. You know, it's like, oh, they have external objects and it's right to say that there's certain things, right? But it's not like that, because these points of view, different points of view, actually make a difference in terms of what an object correctly is. And the traditional example about that, and in other words, an object can be correctly different things depending on the point of view that you're talking about. It's not something naturally from its own side. It can simultaneously, legitimately, and equally be things that are contradictory. So then you're like, oh, now this is going the other way too far. But that's what they're saying. There are external objects, but we can't say what they are except from a point of view. And there can be different legitimate points of view. Okay, so the example that is traditionally given is gods, ghosts, and humans going to the river. And like the gods are, you know, seeing nectar, and the humans are seeing water, and the hungry ghosts are seeing pus and blood. And then it's like, you know, I was like, well, they have their funky hungry ghost karma, so naturally they would get some sign of screwed up idea that water is really pus and blood. But then you have to realize, like, well, we have our funky karma too. And it's like, for us, it's appropriate to see this as water. The hungry ghost is appropriate to see it as pus and blood. They don't have anything wrong with their eyes any more or less than we have something wrong with our eyes. The same with the gods. It's like they've got their god karma makes, in terms of their point of view, it's appropriate for it to be one thing. Hungry ghost karma. It's like, okay, so that's the traditional example. And then people get very, very, there's a lot written about, like, what does this really mean? Not just by Gelugpas, but after Tsongkhapa, people write about and try to explain what's going on. And then Sakyas write and criticize, you know, different Gelugpas explanations of this story. It's really an easier way to think about it, instead of trying to imagine these gods and ghosts and humans, I think, is just to, like, do humans and animals, because we, you know about, we have more ongoing interaction with them than we do with the gods, at least for me. You know, we have a shortage of visible spiders in here due to Natalie and Diana having running around cleaning everything up. But so we can, like, imagine that there are some spiders in here, and it's like, they have all their, these are unimpaired spiders. they're the spider equivalent of 2020. They've got all of their correct eyes with all their correct spider lenses in their eyes and their spider faculties, whatever the heck they are. It's clear that they're like, their spider faculties allow them to, like, you know, see correctly things which it would be weird for us to see, which we would only see if we were on drugs, but is correct for them to see, and vice versa. Do you see what I'm saying? And it's like, oh, so that's kind of strange. You know, I would think that the spider would see something strange because it was a strange little spider, but then I was like, realize it's just naturally, for it, that's the right way to see things, and it couldn't live or function if it saw things the way we do, and vice versa, right? And So then, you know, obviously spiders are an interesting example because they're so different from us, but and we're around them all the time. But if you think about like dogs, it's a little interesting because we've been co-evolving, you know, with dogs for so long, and they're like there's this huge overlap between our kinds of interests and activities. But at the same time, when you take the dog out for the walk, it's like living in smell world, and it's like a million times.
Yeah.
It's like, well, all these things are like, I don't know what's going on here. You know, it's like it's correctly it correctly existing in a same place and same time, and it's correctly ascertaining things, which would be would make it impossible for us to live if we were perceiving. It would be like, and then at the same time, you know, we're interacting with and seeing things that are utterly non-existent or meaningless, you know, and they're non-features of the dog's world. So we have like with spiders and dogs and all these other animals that are around us all the time, we have these like in the same place in the same time, each with correct sense faculties. The world doesn't exist. We think we just kind of, we're species centric. We just kind of think that the we see the world the way it naturally is, and then these other animals have their weird senses of X-ray vision, or you know, seeing infrared light, or having different kinds of eyes, and you know, detecting magnetism, and you know, so they have you know some kinds of weird faculties. But you know, that's just shows they're animals. You know, they wouldn't see things the way that things naturally objectively are. But of course, it's easy to see that's just not the way it is. That they're seeing the world exactly right. You know, if they were able to articulate their philosophy, it would be about, you know, how impaired we were. He can't even smell his whole area. It's like he says he can smell, but I don't know. It's nothing like I could ever, you know. So,
I give up.
yeah. Dogen writes about this like really beautifully in the Mountains and Waters Sutra, which is like not a sutra, right, but an essay written by Dogen. And you know, he's talking about how there are all these, what we think is a world is full of all these different worlds that are simultaneously interpenetratingly present, depending on the correct perspectives of all the different beings that are moving there. It's not like there's one set of objective objects. It's like all these different objects that are correctly appearing to the different kinds of beings that are moving through the same environment. So he's like, I was reminded of that thing about like, that old poem about some people see a tree as this and some people see a tree as that. But it's not just that. Some people don't even see a tree. And it's good that they don't, because that wouldn't be the kind of thing that would, you know, be perceptible to their kinds of sense faculties, right? And you know, he says like, well, dragons see what we call water, to them, that's correctly seen as a palace, right? And he goes on and gives these different examples of how, you know, different creatures are seeing, you know, what we see as X to them is just as vividly appearing as Y. And then Gary Snyder plays with that, and he, you know, switches it over to talking about like mountain goats, you know, or something like this. And it's like, it's a mountain goat. Well, I look at a like a rocky ledge on Mount McKinley covered with ice, and you know, I think death. And the mountain goat says, "Life. I will survive if I can get onto that ledge." You know, so it's like home, safety, security to the goat. Right? So in those kinds of examples, when you talk about like the water and the ledge and so forth, you're kind of like saying, well, there's a certain kind of thing that's there, and then but it appears in a radically different way to these different creatures. But when you think about bats and birds, migratory birds and so forth, it's like you can really think it's like, well, they're, you know, what's appropriately existent or apparent, you know, to these different creatures is completely different. And so anyway, that's the way that Tsongkhapa, you know, gets to this idea that there's like, this is what we mean when we say things don't, there are appropriate, there, things are imputed in relationship to appropriate bases of designation, but both the bases of designation and the appropriateness of the imputation and the imputation itself can't be considered apart from the point of view of a particular kind of being that has a particular kind of perspective. Okay, that's my wave.
Excuse me, guys, which book was that? That you said some people don't even see a tree, but that's right for them.
Oh, I was just playing with that old poem. I don't know, you know, that poem. Some people see a tree. I don't know who it's by. Some people see a tree as something that's in the way. And some, it's an old poem. 20th century woman, poet, about a beautiful tree, how beautiful the tree is. Some people see a tree as a thing of beauty, and to other people it's just something that's in the way and so forth. It just came into my mind. That wasn't one of my main examples.
I thought there was a book you referred to before you mentioned Gary Snyder.
Yeah, Dogen's Mountains and Waters Sutra.
Mountains and Waters.
Yeah, what you should do is look at the book Practice of the Wild by Gary Snyder, and he has a section in there on Dogen and a chapter in there, and that will, it's like a really good introduction to that. And then if you like it, you can go find the Dogen. Okay, so that we're doing pretty well. Okay, so I want to say something about, we started at 5 after, so 20 minutes. I want to say something. I'm going to skip chapter 9, and I skip chapter 8 and say something about chapter 9. I mean, I think that in terms of what's really creative philosophically, by and large, about what Tsongkhapa does, a lot of it is in the part of volume 3 that deals with identifying the object of negation. And basically, we've covered that now. But in terms of, you know, the practice of the path, of course, the actual practice of meditating on emptiness and, you know, realizing lack of self is crucial. It's just that in terms of actual doing that, he just replicates the traditions of Chandrakirti and many other place people that are all in place. And so chapter 9, I don't think has within it one of those sort of brilliant original moves that Tsongkhapa made philosophically that characterized so much of the rest of the insight section. But, you know, it's very, in terms of understanding, you know, this is actually the thing that we have to work on. And who are we? And, you know, we always have this sense of ourselves as vividly existing, and I know, like, people who say that they feel just the same as they did when they're young, but then they always feel surprised when they look in the mirror. Because it's like, well, I don't actually feel like a different person than I did before. I don't actually have so much like that, because my memory is so bad for what my experience was like when I was younger. And so I don't think I have this, like, vivid sense that I'm the same person that I was at a certain time. Or maybe I, you know, I don't know. I'm not sure what it is. But I know this is very common among, you know, many people, like, of a certain age, right, have said this to me. Is like, that they're constantly dismayed at the age of their body, because they don't feel like they've become a different person inside, yet they can, like, hardly recognize their outer shell. You know, this, you know, the real me is this young person who's still living inside his body. And so anyway, that has something to do with this paradox of, you know, trying to figure out who we are as I ask one, you know, thinking about who are we, trying to meditate on, like, well, what is it that we think we are, and do we really exist in the way that we think we do? One time I was, like, in a class, and I, you know, said, well, your thoughts are changing instant by instant, so if you are your thoughts, you know, they're constantly running away, and they're turning into something completely different, so you don't have any, like, stable, same self that you think you have, or just reflexively assume that you have. And then, just as you were saying, you know, your body doesn't seem to change. It doesn't seem to change as fast. But then, you know, so you kind of assume that it's not changing, but then, oh, it definitely is. It doesn't change as fast as the speed of thought, but it definitely changes. And I asked this person, like, well, who do you think you are? And she said, well, I'm my feelings. I was like, well, that was interesting. I hadn't thought of that, you know. But it's like she vividly identifies that she's not her ideas, she's not her thoughts, she's not her concepts, she's not her body. But the core of her is, you know, her emotional life. She is what she feels, you know. That's interesting. Of course, you know, it doesn't solve the problem at all, but it's like, oh, that's another place we can sort of look and see, you know, how we're identifying ourselves. So are we, like, real? Are we, is there a certain feeling that we are? You know, of course, the feeling problem is the same as, like, the other one. It's just as impermanent and fluctuating. And actually, His Holiness was doing a little bit with that in the piece of video we were just watching. You know, he's saying, well, even if you have a person with a strong inclination to hatred and malice, you know, a hateful person, you can call them a hateful person. Why? Because it's a persistent character of their personality, you know, to engage in hateful actions. Even such a person is not hateful every single moment. They have probably some moments in which they do not have hateful feelings. And then he actually said, well, even such a person will have some moments in which they feel loving kindness, which is exactly the opposite of how they and other people are thinking of their essential identity as just naturally, intrinsically hateful. So, like, sometimes they're the opposite of who, you know, if we're thinking of them in terms of that kind of thing as their essential nature, sometimes they're the opposite of themselves. Which, of course, doesn't make any sense. And it must be that they don't have that kind of hateful essence that we thought they had. And that was, of course, the point that His Holiness was making. So, just to give a summary of this briefly, and then I'll read a little bit of where I ended up with in terms of thinking about the person in this chapter. As I was describing before, you have to, you know, begin meditating on emptiness, like first understanding intellectually what you're doing, and then in meditative practice, try to identify the object of negation, not as a philosophical concept. It might not even be the right object of negation at first. You know, it's like the subtle object of negation, that sense of myself as a person that exists from its own side without depending upon the force of consciousness to impute it. Well, that might be a little hard to, like, get at the first go or second or third go around. But it's like, okay, well, what do I think of myself? How what is it that I'm grasping on that I think of as the real me? You have to, like, play around with these things, as Jeffrey said, and not just, like, hold it outside yourself as some ideas that I can't afford to get wrong. But like Geshe Rabthen did, you know, his teacher showed him a 100-rupee note, and he didn't just, like, okay, let's write a thesis about this argument for conventional existence. He went up into a retreat and tried to, like, okay, who do I think I am? And in what way does this self that I think I am have any relationship to this example of a note? So that is going, you know, the step beyond, like, getting the words in the right order is to figure out, like, how does this apply to me? And in that kind of practice, the idea is to try to, like, catch yourself in the act of having one of those moments where a forceful or vivid sense of I is arising, and see who it is that you think what it is that you think is the core of your being, that's like this the kind of self that you're grasping onto. And you identify this in meditation, and then you consider, this is the self that I, you know, if this self strongly, vividly existed in the way that it appears, then, and then you have to make a list of, like, well, what are all the possible ways that it could exist? The key thing about this second step is that you have to make a list that you yourself personally, subjectively, feel will be comprehensive. It doesn't matter whether it's, like, comprehensive, if it's redundant. In fact, usually most of these lists are in some sense redundant. But make sure that it's inclusive. Like, you know, if we think that there's an elephant hiding in the schoolhouse, and someone's very confused, and Natalie's been subjected to this delusion quite a bit, and to help her, we'll have to, like, make a list of, if it were in the schoolhouse, Natalie, and then we'll make a list of all the places that it could be. And it can be over inclusive, you know. We can include some places that kind of overlap and say it could be on the first floor, it could be on the second floor, and it could be in the teaching room. Well, that overlaps with the second floor. Yeah, but that's all right. We'll just, like, have a list, though, that we'll make sure subjectively, what about, could it be right outside that door, you know, on the ledge there, you know? And so, like, we'll make a very thorough list of all the places that this, you know, this elephant could be, And so that then we can go and search in each of these places. And when we find no elephant in each of these places, she'll have a problem. Because in her mind, there will still be vividly appearing this kind of force of this thought that there's an elephant. Yet she'll have this direct evidence that in each of the places that she agreed it would have to be in one of those places, if it were here at all, it was not in any of those places. So it's like this force of this inference, you know, the non-existence of the elephant was butting up against the vivid appearance that's still in her mind that, yeah, there ought to be one here somewhere, you know. And then, like, after a while practicing that, she could get disabused of that notion, and start the force of the inference will undermine that delusion. I don't think it's like that you know, it immediately, these things have a strong grip on the mind, you know, and it takes a while of repeatedly getting habituated to a new way of seeing it for it to sink in. So that's the idea, is that, you know, you substitute the elephant, you put in the idea of a really inherently existent self. And the idea is, we have to make, if we had a self that existed in and of itself in the way that this self is appearing to me, it would have to be, for example, and the short version is, but that's only really, you should do a longer version, but the short version would be, say, well, the self, if it existed as it appears, it would have to be either one with my mental and physical aggregates, or it would have to be other than them. You know, it would have to be the same, or it would have to be different with the mind and body that's the basis of imputation for that kind of self. In the book, I use the example of the married bachelor that I made up instead of the example of the elephant, because, you know, the married bachelor is the idea of something that's like logically contradictory, and it's not like the elephant that, you know, could really be in the schoolhouse and maybe, you know, it was sneaking out the back door and coming around the front door while we were searching, and it's like, it's very, you know, actually could be here somewhere. And it's not, so the analysis is not a physical searching, it's a logical analysis that demonstrates that it's really impossible for this ever, you know, what we were talking earlier about emptiness is a non-contingent, although, even though it's a dependent arising. So it's like, it's built into the way, it is the way things are, that things can't exist in and of themselves. So the married bachelor is this idea of something that's just contradictory. And you could say, well, if someone's suffering because they believe in this impossible married bachelor thing and they come to you as a therapist, you know, you can give them medication, or or you could say, okay, so you believe in this married bachelor. Is that person, do you think that, you know, would that person be wed or unwed? And it's like, let's consider, you know, wouldn't that be kind of a, wouldn't the person have to be either wed or unwed? And then, because, you know, and then we'll go through and say, oh, they can't be wed, you know, because they're married, they're a bachelor, and they can't be unwed because they're married. And it's like, oh, well, yeah, but I know that there is this married bachelor, you know, and yeah, but looks review. And after a few years, I was like, oh, yeah, I have a suspicion that, even though I still kind of believe in this, that I might be believing in something that doesn't exist. And then, and after a while, you get, you know, certain levels of doubt get stronger and stronger, and the person still has some force of appearance that this ought to be out there, but then they start to recognize that appearance is something that is false for them. Oh, it reminds me of that movie, A Beautiful Mind. Mm-hmm. Did you think of that? Right. It's like that guy is like, oh yeah, I'm hallucinating. But, you know, I've gotten used to it. I recognize that, you know, there's not really a person sitting over there. You know, it's like, wow, you know, what power, right? Yeah. So in the case of the person, you know, if the person that, instead of the, you know, Mary Bachelor, if we're believing this person that exists in and of itself, you know, you'd have to look, you say, if it's either in the, you would do a longer list than one with the aggregates or different from the aggregates, right? And you can see in the great treatise and many other books, you know, lists of the different ways of doing this. But just for the short version, you say, well, it has to be the same or it has to be different. There's one with the mind and body. Then the mind and body are different and complicated. They're diverse. There's mind, there's body, there's lots of different parts of the body. All of these parts are changing all the time. It's like, so is that what it, we must have lots of different selves. Like I have a toe self and I have an anger self and I have a knee self. And it's like, well, but that's not like what this self is like. It's not like that. So it must not, you know, if it's one with the mind and body, then it would be diffuse and continuously changing. Whereas the whole point is like, I'm this one owner and controller that's in here. That's like the master of all these parts. So it must be something different from the mind and body. Right, but if it exists in and of itself, and it's different in, you know, its nature is like different from the mind and body, then it's what? Why does it need the mind and body? It's like I could have my mind and body over here, and then this real self of me can go over there. I was thinking that astral travel might be like that. Leave my body behind and my mind will go, but maybe you could leave your mind and body behind and your real self will go out and check out the moons around Saturn and how they're doing, you know. I don't know if that's what people think or not, but it's like this sense is like, if there's a real me that's not my mind and a real me that's like not my body, then it could go off by itself and do its own thing. It might be happier without me. But then that, of course, is a problem too, right? It's like, So if you could like go through all these, like there are many different arguments, you know, I'm just doing super short. It's like arguments like not the same as, not different than, then you get to the sense, well, maybe this sense, this vivid sense of a real self that I have here is counterfactual. It doesn't really correspond to the way things conventionally exist. You know, it doesn't, and people then might be frightened, you know, and have the self that they've believed in and clung to is starts to evaporate or collapse. Then there's, it could be a sense of disappearing or being afraid, right? But people become accustomed to that and they realize that it doesn't cancel out their existence. You know, but it actually opens up the possibilities of what choices they can make. They don't have a sense of a fixed identity that they have to be bound to. You can become even maybe more compassionate and more wise than we thought was even possible, right? Because you don't have any intrinsic nature, as this holiness is saying. It's the good news of emptiness, right? The hope. This is what he's saying. Is like hope that we get from emptiness is that not only is that emptiness telling us that things don't exist the way they forcefully appear, but also it's telling us that we don't have the intrinsically existent afflictions, that they're not built into our nature. You know, we have a kind of, in a sense, you could say, primordial purity. That is, like, in terms of our basic nature, there's nothing locked in about the kind of selfishness and stupidity that we have now. Mm. Okay, so let me just read one passage and then I'll look at the questions. This is toward the end of, it's on page 95 in Introduction to Emptiness. Through meditating on how things are empty because they're dependent arisings, we retrain our minds to see that things exist only insofar as they're related to other things, and none of which is ultimately real. Nothing has its own way to set itself up. Each and everything is the expression of vast networks of relationships with and among other things. Those relationships, of course, also not being intrinsically existent because they exist only as in relationship to the things that they relate. There is no bottom, no absolute ground of being, no unconditioned support or starting point. Everything emerges from the surging and relentless complexity of innumerable interdependent conditions, every one of which is itself analytically unlocatable. Implicit in clichés such as every snowflake is unique is a celebration of our own uniqueness as living beings. The problem is only that we believe, usually unconsciously, that our uniqueness arises from an inner essence that is our private core. And to defend and aggrandize that core, we harm others. To nurture that core, we build up our greed. We act as though malicious anger were our protective father and craving our sustaining mother. And no one can begin to measure how much pain and anguish this has caused. In fact, we are unique, and our uniqueness arises from our distinctive, ever-shifting, and infinite array of connections with other things. We're unique and important, but we do not own our own uniqueness. We have no intrinsic core. We owe our uniqueness to all of our conditions and to our emptiness. For it's only in the open sky of emptiness that the rest without the open sky of emptiness, the rest of the world could not shine into and through us, and we could never be what we are, living beings making choices that matter. Okay, so now we're going to look at questions. Why not use dependent arising more like by saying X is a dependent arising at least as often as saying X is not inherently existent? Didn't Nagarjuna or maybe Tsongkhapa say the teaching on dependent arising is the greatest in the treasury of Buddhist knowledge? Yes. Yes, I don't think there's any, I don't mean by writing a book on emptiness to disparage dependent arising. The point of actually, Tsongkhapa's, the main point that Tsongkhapa was in the Great Treatise was he was really trying to say exactly what you're saying, is that dependent arising is the import of emptiness. It's what, emptiness is what makes dependent arising possible. Nothing about emptiness impairs dependent arising, and that people who think that are making an error. The reason that Buddha talks about emptiness instead of just settling for dependent arising is, as I tried to explain earlier, that there are many people who believe in dependent arising. Many Buddhist realists believe in dependent arising, and they're quite sure that dependent arising works precisely because each thing has its own distinctive character from its own side, which allows it to function as the cause of the next thing. And that's a reason why those people were so freaked out by Nagarjuna, and that's why they Nagarjuna imagines himself being attacked by them in the whole first half of the 24th chapter of the treatise. He's saying, you know, you talk about emptiness, you're destroying dependent arising, because for us, dependent arising means that things have to have their own nature. So in order to work, to make dependent arising work. So I think personally that this is a very important point. I think like maybe a lot we're made uncomfortable by the negativity of the idea of emptiness. And so like in this case, maybe some people would just prefer to talk about dependent arising, or I know other friends of mine who really just want to talk about how everything exists conventionally and not really talk about emptiness or ultimate truth at all. And you say ultimate truth is absolutely like, well, some people say, well, the ultimate truth is that there is no ultimate truth. It's just a way of like talking about how conventional truths are. Well, that's sort of true, but it's like not exactly right, right? The idea is that when when you ask of things, what is this really? And you search to see what is the nature of the book, you don't at last come to some, oh, now I found that it is from its own side like a dependent arising. What you find is like there's nothing findable. That lack of anything graspable is emptiness. And that's what makes it possible for dependent arising to work. So it's because we have this reified idea of how things exist that you have to put forward something negative as like the thing you must realize in order to cancel out the extra that you're adding on to everything and causing the difficulty, or adding on to it, or ascribing to it as it having from its inside. Okay, so we could talk more about that, but there's other questions. Here's another hard one. To say we have reliable sense perception, does that not imply that there is something we are getting from the object side of the perceptual experience? And there's a lot more explanation of that, but I think we get the thrust of the of the question. And actually, this I read before, and I tried to build it in the best I can say about it into what I said earlier. There is, like, for everything we're ascribing and identifying and imputing, there are bases of imputation. But then those bases of imputation are appropriately perceived as X by beings of type Y, and not as though they have some intrinsic, objectively established character in and of themselves to be that, you know. So there are external objects. It's just that there are contradictory, correct ways to perceive them. So when you think about that, then it sort of undermines your sense that these for them to be external must mean that they're objectively real. These external objects don't exist. You can't say, okay, they're external objects. What are they? they're of a certain sort from a human point of view, but that they're equally legitimately or validly or reliably identified in different ways from different points of view. Okay. Can emptiness of other be called fullness as expressed by other traditions of teachings? What is your concept of fullness as expressed by other teachers? Is there any connection to Buddhism? Okay, I made up fullness. I don't really know. I didn't make it up. A student in my class made it up. Like, she was like unhappy with emptiness. She realized emptiness meant the interdependent, dependent arising sounds like better than emptiness. What would, if everything's interconnected with everything else, then, you know, we could call that fullness. And she just thought that would be a happier way to express it. So I already talked about why I thought that didn't, address, that there was a reason why that wasn't the traditional Buddhist choice. So then the question, why is your concept, is there any connection to Bolan? Well, just since the word fullness is in quotation marks here, it seems like the person is really specifically talking about the concept of fullness. But I would say that, like, if you think of fullness as something, not just as a way of saying that things are interconnected, but that they're kind of filled up by one another and have a nature that it's established via their relationships with one another. At some point, you start to get to a point where, you have something other than the idea of things being unfindable under analysis. You could say things are full of some real nature that we could find. It may not be the simple kind of self-identity that we expected. It might be that when we search to see what they really are, we'll find that they have an essence of being dependent arisings. And it's like some idea of essentially existent dependent arisings. That's the eco matrix of that's at the core, and we can grasp hold of that. That's like really definitely not what the Buddha is teaching. So, it's like in this text, Tsongkhapa is saying, he's pushing dependent arising really hard in another text as well, because he wants to ward off a nihilistic implication of emptiness. But there's other texts where he said, when we say that emptiness and dependent arising have the same meaning, you shouldn't think that that literally means that they're synonyms. It doesn't. It's not. Emptiness is the sheer lack of inherent nature in things. And in some sense, I use the phrase cashes out as, in terms of purport or how that works out. If you really understand dependent arising, then you understand what? That nothing exists by its objectively, except insofar as it is perceived through the force of consciousness. And what is that? That's saying that it doesn't have any intrinsic nature of its own, that it exists. That the dependence of dependent arising, that's the real meaning of emptiness, is not, these things depend on causes or parts. It's like that they don't have any way of being objectively that's independent of a point of view. Like he's saying, it's like, let's set aside the perspective of how minds see X and just ask what X is from its own side. Well, they don't have something that they are naturally or objectively are from their own side. Right, and so in that way, when you really understand dependent arising, you see that it cashes out to the same thing as emptiness. In one text, Tsongkhapa says, Well, there's so many different ways to misunderstand what we mean when we say that the purport of emptiness or the, you know, cashes out is the same as emptiness. But, you know, one thing we can say that's correct, there's so many wrong things to say. One right thing to say is that if you realize emptiness and then you think and you turn your mind to dependent arising, the very word dependent in dependent arising will immediately reawaken in you your sense of understanding of emptiness. Because you'll understand that this dependence is the lack of independent objective existence that you just finished realizing. Okay. Down to the last two. With regard to the other emptiness school with Buddha nature as universal and within all beings, does Tsongkhapa dispute this focus on Buddha nature, or does he negate the universal reality of Buddha nature, or does he do neither? Tsongkhapa, when, you know, talking from the point of view of his own system, the Prasangika, you know, there is such a thing as Buddha nature, but Tsongkhapa understands it as being a way of talking about the fact that we have minds or streams of consciousness that are empty and therefore, as His Holiness was describing on that video, open to or have the possibility or potential, right, to transformation into the complete minds of Buddha. Also, you could say another way you could say is like because our minds have empty of, and he also was talking about this when he's talking about true cessations, is saying right now our minds don't have any essential nature of being afflicted. Or he didn't say this, but you could say right now our minds have no essential nature of being different from Buddha's minds, right? And if you can use emptiness to say that, like, Buddha's mind is essentially funded from an ultimate point of view, there's like has complete purity. There's no trace of graspable afflictions in the Buddha's mind. There's no trace of graspable afflictions in our mind. You know, so there's a lot of ways of, you know, using emptiness to talk about Buddha nature as like something that's in some way, you know, what we have right now is a ultimate non-difference from Buddha's and the purity of Buddha's mind, and also the potential for us actualizing that, you know, by practicing the path, because there's nothing that obstructs it. Because of emptiness, opens the door. But what Tsongkhapa doesn't want to do is like posit an ultimate reality that has some positive or affirmative aspect to it, that is like some positive self, either some positive thing or some kind of self-existent thing. He doesn't want to do either one. Now, you do kind of have to distinguish those two things. I mean, Tsongkhapa's ultimate reality is a sheer negation. You know, it's like a mere absence, right? And some people could say, well, we would like to have some kind of affirming negative, you know, something that was the absence, some kind of absence, but that the absence in itself bodied forth something positive, and count that also as part of what we mean by the ultimate, right? And then we could still agree that none of these things is inherently existent, right? Right. But this then becomes like, I mean, this could be things that some other schools say, but it's not Gyalupa. Gyalupa is saying, first of all, you can't have anything that exists in and of itself. And when you're talking about the ultimate reality, you say you have to be meaning that which the mind comes to when it asks of anything, what is this really? And if you stick something positive in there, is like what the mind is grasping onto, then you're not going to be able to get out of saying that that thing is like essentially real, because it's some, you know, positive graspable thing that the mind, ultimate mind, gets a hold of when it asks of the cup, what is it really? So in the Gyalupa way, as soon as you put something positive in the place of like the on the side of the ultimate nature, you're going to go down the path towards saying that there's some self-existent thing. So they don't want to do that. But, you know, there are other schools who will agree that there's no self, that even emptiness is empty, that anything you posit as ultimate reality is empty. But that doesn't mean necessarily they mean that they like this idea of it being a sheer negation. You're going to try to get something like in some way positive in as part of it. And then at the extreme end of that, you have people like Sherup Gelson who are saying, oh yeah, there are things that are self-existent, and that's the ultimate reality is self-existent. That's the one thing that is self-existent. And for Tsongkhapa, that's like, you could say anathema, you know, that's like, he considers that to be like going outside of Buddhism. that's basically, and it, subsequent Gilukpas also say like that, that, okay, you're basically a Vedantin or some other kind of, you know, Hindu philosopher at that point. You're not really have a Buddha. You could be a Buddhist, but you're not, your philosophy is not. Yeah, because, you know, you just don't understand what the three jewels are really about. Please comment on emptiness of death, emptiness of space, and emptiness of rebirth. Emptiness of death. Yeah. Well, first of all, everything is empty that you can turn your mind to. So things exist only in relationship to other things. They don't have any, like, findable nature in and of themselves. So, you know, all what that in these things, you know, it's like most important way, as I just finished saying what that means is that death is that which, you know, we designate or assign as death. There's no sort of like objectively, independently, inherently existent death, you know. And what do we designate as death? We designate it in relationship to the moment or the process of the ending of, you know, ending of the association of this stream of consciousness of this lifetime with this particular set of aggregates, that physical aggregates as the material base. So you can say, well, you know, you can't even posit death conventionally except in relationship to a process of the of changing of the mental and physical continuum. It doesn't exist objectively in and of itself from the own side. You could say, like, for mortal beings, it's like, you know, well, this is definitely going to happen, but it doesn't mean that it's non-empty, right? Things can be certain or non-contingent, right, and still be exist only interdependently or relationally. I'm thinking maybe that's why you asked that. And of course, I don't know why rebirth is exactly the same, so I mean, I don't have anything different to say about that. The emptiness of space. Space, as you usually think of it, as like the mere absence of obstructive contact. So space is not usually thought of as an impermanent. It's not changing moment by moment. It's thought of as something rather that's designated by the mind. But nevertheless, so it exists in relationship to a consciousness that's designating space. You could say also that, you know, since space is like a field, a devoid of obstructive contact, that you can divide space up into parts. You don't have space like changing moment by moment in this system. But you can say that space has parts and space is designated by the mind. So they're like permanent things, like this, like how Buddhists talk about space, that are nonetheless empty because they exist as something that are imputed by the mind in relationship to a collection of parts. The eastern part of the space and the western part of the space are there together in relationship to that. We say, oh, there's the space that, and the space that makes it possible for the solar system to be here, or it makes it possible for the table to be here, you know, is like there wasn't anything preventing the table from moving here. That's what we mean by the space that the table's in. But there's still this part of it and that part of it, and that's in relationship to which we designate the space for the table. Okay. I think that's it. Did I miss any? I didn't miss any. Okay.
Seems good to me.
Yeah. I'm getting the pointer. Thanks for coming, Nancy. Oh, yeah.
You got it. Thank you very much. That's where you want to go.
Yeah, she's thanking you.
Oh, I was happy to do it. Thanks for coming. Getting up so early.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah.
She was fearless, determined.
Did you say you were busy?
I wasn't. There was something else.
Nothing going on out there. Yeah.
Just the waves coming in and lapping against the shore on the beach.
That's where I went yesterday.
yesterday afterwards to contemplate it all.
Oh, I see. She's in Maui, right? You're in Maui, right?
Yeah, she's in Maui. Okay, so we're going to dedicate.
Doing hospice.
I know.
I dedicate all this virtue to emulate the knowledge of the hero Manjushri and likewise Samantabhadra as well. With whatever dedication is praised as supreme by all the conquerors who traverse the three times, I also dedicate all my roots of virtue for the sake of auspicious deeds.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gaia. Thank you, everyone. And this is certainly what I envision our learning intensives to be, where somebody's talking very passionately about, you know, Buddhist ideas, and everybody else is listening very intently, and also asking questions and discussing it amongst each other. And
yeah, there was a good atmosphere, definitely.
Yeah, really, it was a wonderful weekend. So,
excellent.
So thank you all for all your participation. I did want to mention before you go that next week, Amy, who was on Skype, Amy Miller, will be coming to teach on Sunday, our regular Sunday class, and she'll be giving a historical perspective. It'll be something slightly different than what we usually do here. We're usually using a text, and she will be teaching about, well, her starting point, she says, is going to be the historical origins of the Tibetan Buddhist canon, and sort of just seeing where these teachings are coming from. So that'll be very helpful. So if any of you are interested, you're all welcome to come.
Online audio?
Online, yeah. And then we're planning on putting these the tapes of today up online. And so you'll be able to download those to review what it was. What did he say? What was that?
Say what?
External objects, but we don't know what they are.
Oh, wow, they just quit like that.
Well, there she's gone.
She's gone. Like,
so bye.
That was like Star Wars, you know, they went into warp speed.